Chapter 11, Monks and Laymen. In 1965, I started keeping a diary. My entry for Friday the 1st of January began with a summary of my reflections as I faced the new year, then went on to record the principal events of the day, which apart from the fact that there were no lectures, no classes and no travel, was a fairly representative one. The entry was as follows. After 20 years in the East, I find myself, at the beginning of 1965, in England, where I have now spent more than 4.5 months. Not unexpectedly, this has been a busy period, though an interesting one. And I feel, so far as the Buddhist movement in this country is concerned, a time of crucial importance. I go on to reflect on the state of the British Buddhist community, which I had found to be practically split, at least in part as a consequence of Ananda Bodhi's behaviour, to say nothing of his teaching, and its application of questionable meditation techniques. Quote, on one side stood the Sangha Trust, the Sangha Association, and the Hampstead Buddhist Vihara. On the other, the Buddhist Society. Now Ananda Bodhi is out, and, we hope, peace and harmony have been restored. During 1965, may I progress towards supreme enlightenment, and with the blessings of all the Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, Dharmapalas, and Dakinis, may the Dharma continue to spread in England. Rose at 6:15 and attended puja in the shrine room with Venerable Dhammaloka from Ceylon, Venerable Mahavichitta from Thailand, Venerable Vimalo from Germany, Reverend Kashyapa from England, and Kenneth, USA, who with Venerable S as incumbent and head of the English Sangha make up our community at the Hampstead Vihara. Spent the whole morning in puja and reflection, reading the Bodhisattva Shila and going through the various meditation texts translated from the Tibetan. Pleasantly interrupted by a phone call from Holland from Retchung Rinpoche, whom I last saw in Kalimpong more than 3 years ago. Said his colleague, a Tibetan monk I probably met in India, would be coming to England for a few weeks and would like to stay with me if convenient. In the afternoon, a long talk with Mr. Revel about the affairs of the London Buddhist Vihara, Chiswick. All by no means well, it seems. Read latest New Statesman. Very peculiar behaviour by Vimalo. Had to speak to him strongly, almost harshly. In the end, he saw his mistake and apologised, but the incident left me disturbed. As it showed, he was not psychologically balanced, and that I would have to give attention to his spiritual development, whereas I had thought before that he was sufficiently advanced to be able to get on without my interposition. No one seems really normal. Mrs. Phillips came, discussed various people. She gave me, as a New Year present, the material for a Tibetan jacket. In the evening, a long talk about Buddhism, with Abraham's friend Reuben, who did not leave till 10:30. Ananda Bodhi had indeed upset a lot of people. There was little doubt that he had an exaggerated idea of his own importance, and little doubt, too, that he had misled at least some of those who had come into contact with him. His so-called insight meditation retreats at Biddulph involved the observing of complete silence, except for the daily 10-minute interview with the teacher, himself, and the systematic reduction of sleep to a maximum of 4 hours a night. Such a regimen, with its lack of ordinary human communication and lack of sleep, together with long periods in the same posture, was sufficiently demanding to risk bringing about the unhealthy mental state for which I subsequently coined the term alienated awareness, or worse, in the unprepared or vulnerable. There are also serious doctrinal misunderstandings. Sensations of pain in meditation, the meditator was told, was a sign that insight, transcendental insight, was being achieved. experience of the fact of suffering thus was confused, simply on account of its occurring within the framework of meditation, with the experience of transcendental insight into the Buddha's noble truth of suffering, a very different thing. Moreover, the achievement of transcendental insight being equivalent to breaking one or more of the fetters binding to mundane existence, the meditator was encouraged to think that he had attained, or was in process of attaining, stream entry, the first stage of the transcendental path leading directly to nirvana. I had encountered misunderstandings of this kind before in India. A Buddhist friend who had attended a so-called insight meditation course in Burma, the original home of the method, returned with a certificate stating that he had completed the course and attained stream entry. The certificate was signed by Mahasi Sayadaw, the leading monastic, as distinct from lay, insight meditation teacher of his generation. Ananda Bodhi did not hand out certificates, so far as I know, but the fact that it was he who authenticated or did not authenticate the spiritual achievements of his disciples was sufficient to invest him, in their eyes, with tremendous authority, an authority which the formal insight meditation interviews, with their repeated threefold prostrations, tended to reinforce. It also made the more susceptible of them dependent on his advice and approval, even in quite minor matters. But if I thought that I now had little more to learn about Ananda Bodhi, I was greatly mistaken. I, in fact, had a lot more to learn, as I was to discover less than a month later, when light was suddenly thrown upon him and his activities from a totally unexpected quarter. The latter half of my diary entry introduces several new characters. Dhammaloka was a simple, scholarly monk who, at Ratanasara's invitation, had come from Ceylon to teach Pali at the London Buddhist College, which, as yet, was no more than a weekly class or two held in the basement of the Vihara. After his arrival, it transpired that Ratanasara had promised his old friend that he would meet all his travel expenses, provide him with board and lodging, and pay him a handsome monthly salary. Or rather, he had promised that the Sangha Trust would do so, as the Trust had not authorized him to make these promises on its behalf, and as it was, in any case, not in a position to pay anyone a handsome salary. The figure Ratanasara had mentioned was ludicrously high, especially for a monk. There was the inevitable showdown, first between Ratanasara and the Trust, and then between Ratanasara and Dhammaloka. In the end, the latter, who was much less worldly-minded than his colleague, agreed to teach at the college in return for board and lodging, plus a reasonable amount of pocket money. He was therefore accommodated in the house next door, which the Trust also owned, and which had been divided into flats that were its principal source of income. During the time of his stay with us, he proved to be a conscientious teacher, as well as a friendly and helpful member of our little community. Kashyapa was the elder of the two English novices, and the one I had heard on my first morning at the Vihara, ordering supplies on the phone and asking for the more expensive kind of salmon to be sent. I have already characterized him as saturnine, 40 or more, of medium height, and formerly a civil engineer. He moved slowly and said very little. Occasionally, for no apparent reason, he would let out a low chuckle. As Ananda Bodhi had left him on my hands without telling me anything about him, it was only later that I came to know he'd been quite ill and suffered from some form of mental illness. His GP warned me that he would have to be kept under constant supervision, and it would be better if he did not stay at the Vihara. In consultation with Satatissa, his official preceptor, I therefore made arrangements for him to disrobe and return to lay life, and, I hoped, proper medical care. Kenneth was one of the handful of men who, during my incumbency, spent a few days or a few weeks at the Vihara, either because they were in search of peace of mind or because they wanted to have a taste of community life. I remember no more about him than I remember about Abraham's friend Reuben, who is mentioned at the end of my diary entry. Abraham himself I remember only as a youngish man with problems, who talked a lot and who sometimes kept me up until very late at night. As my reference to him suggests, Retchen Rinpoche was an incarnate lama whom I had known in Kalimpong. Born into the aristocratic Pyongkang family, at the age of 13 he'd been recognized as the 14th reincarnation of Rinchung, the gifted but wayward disciple of the great yogi Milarepa, and author of the famous biography of his master. Like other lamas who had arrived in India in the aftermath of the Chinese occupation, he had eventually been offered employment in the West, and was now working with a Dutch scholar in Leiden. In Kalimpong he had lived with his two brothers, one of whom was also an incarnate lama, the other being the husband of the eldest daughter of the Maharaja of Sikkim. Pyong Kangse, the married brother, was already a friend of mine, and Rechung and I were soon acquainted. During his years in the hill station, he was a frequent visitor to my monastery, studied English with me, and was always ready to collaborate with me in my Buddhist activities there. By the time he left for the West, he had become my closest friend among the incarnate lamas, so that when he phoned me from Holland, I was glad to hear his familiar voice. Like Kashyapa, William Revel had been a civil engineer. He was now retired. But unlike Kashyapa, he was cheerful, talkative, and very long-winded. A white-haired, ruddy-faced bachelor who lived with his mother in one of the remoter suburbs, he often spent the whole day at the Vihara, bringing his sandwiches with him in a small attaché case that also contained an assortment of tools and copies of his most recent correspondence. Occasionally he came to complain about the monks attached to the London Buddhist Vihara, as the Sinhalese Buddhist Centre at Chiswick was officially styled. None of them understood him, he declared. They had treated him very badly. He was particularly critical of Vinita, a young monk with whom he had struck up a friendship, which, if Revel was to be believed, was being undermined by the monk's obtuseness, intellectual dishonesty, and inability to admit that a bhikkhu might commit a mistake in relation to a layman. As evidence of Vinita's shortcomings and the correctness of his own position, he produced from his attaché case copies of the letters they had exchanged over the last few months. His own were of considerable length, written in a crabbed hand with many underlinings, and so obscure and tortuous in expression that it was difficult to make out what he was saying, except that he was in the right and his friend in the wrong. Vinita, a pleasant, good-natured monk whom I had met once or twice, and who clearly was out of his depth dealing with someone like Revel, had confined himself to typewritten general expressions of goodwill and esteem that the obstinate, eccentric old man found highly unsatisfactory. Some months later, Vinita and a Sinhalese monk, whom I had come to know in Calcutta, while staying at the headquarters of the Mahabodhi Society, left England to teach at the Washington Buddhist Vihara, then the principal Theravadin Centre in the United States. One day, they went out together for a walk and were not seen again. At least they were not seen again for many months, and not in America. When eventually they did resurface, it was in Japan, 2 years later, by which time both had disrobed and married. Had they been as much out of their depth with American Buddhists as Vinita had been with William Revel, I wondered? And had this had anything to do with their dramatic disappearance from the scene?